Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
It's been common in my experience, says my next guest in a recent article, for older people to decline cognitively or even be made incontinent and immobile by the hospitalisation process. Over the years, families have frequently reported their shock at the emaciated, functionally dependent shadow of their former selves delivered home to them after a hospital stay. Such is the damning indictment of our hospital system. According to our opening guest this morning, who's Professor Ronan Collins, a consultant physician in geriatric and stroke medicine at Talla Hospital. Good morning, Professor Collins.
Good morning.
You certainly were not sitting on the fence in regards to that one. You continue to say, in my experience over the years, many initiatives to improve the lot of patients in hospitals have been thwarted by a lack of resource, priority, or the basic inability to put ourselves in another person's shoes.
Yeah, I think that's probably very accurate. I think one of the things you notice, I suppose, when you've been in medicine for a while is that you almost become conditioned to the surroundings that you see around you in the hospitals, in the wards, in emergency departments, etc. And it almost becomes a second nature and you accept it that this is the way things are, this is the way things are done. Now, I'm not talking about individual hospitals here. I want to make this clear. This is true for the majority of our hospitals across the country. Our estate and bed stock is aging, is probably not fit for modern purpose, and I think the pandemic has thrown some focus on that as well. But I've been cognizant for some time, really, of the effect of the hospital environment on patients, particularly on older patients, and also on our staff. It's very difficult for staff also to have any sense of pride, or even to feel in some way rewarded in their work when they're working in such difficult circumstances, and trying to maintain patient privacy and dignity and encourage people to get well in what can be very challenging circumstances. And there's no doubt, you know, clinically, and many of my colleagues will tell you this, that the environment is a very important factor in healing people from illness. And if the environment is not right, you're at a disadvantage from the start.
Well, let's look at why the environment isn't right. You say it's been a bugbear of mine as a doctor, both here and in the UK. Geriatricians and specialised multidisciplinary teams, amongst others, invest much effort in trying to prevent poor outcomes for older people during hospitalisation, though the hospital environment often subverts our efforts before they have even begun. Pretty strong condemnation.
Well, it is. Well, if you look at the hospital design, so, you know, let's take many of the instances. I mentioned in my letter, or mentioned in my discussion document, and the purpose of this is that, although it's my opinion, is that I wanted to start a discussion on this. First of all, if the hospital environment, I mentioned in the letter about older people being made incontinent, which is a strong emotive thing to say in a document, maybe. But first of all, if you start from the front door process to the emergency department all the way up, you know, if people don't have help to mobilise, if they're not in appropriate bedding where they can get on and off safely, if there's not appropriate adequate toilet facilities to allow people to get to the toilet in time and to be assisted in toileting, then de facto what happens is people become incontinent. And that's not unusual in our system, unfortunately. And that starts the process of, number one, psychologically damaging a patient, and number two, starts the process of disabling them. And I think that's an important thing that we need to recognise.
And
if you go into our hospitals, just to finish that point,
yeah,
one of the things that's a particular concern of mine is our toileting facilities are not up to scratch.
So we're talking about basically the facilities and the overcrowding of those facilities, which you describe as fundamentally dehumanising on patients, staff and those around them, for our sickest patients to have to be toileted or have their painful, odorous wounds dressed in such a public fashion in open bays with the ubiquitous and useless plasticated curtain drawn around.
Well, that's true. I think the hospitals, you know, when they initially started, were very much of a Nightingale ward type design. And you know, I worked in the UK where I saw the hangover of the World War II wards as well, you know, where we would have had, you know, 15, 20 people on a ward. So certainly we moved beyond that. But I think it's very clear as well, although we do need some open ward designs, particularly where we're looking after some of the more critically ill people and people that maybe need a kind of watchful eyes on, they need to be properly designed with adequate space, with adequate facilities for appropriate toileting of people to respect people's privacy. But in many of our wards, that doesn't exist. And it is very hard, both for patients and staff, to have to be toileted by, for example, in bedpans and commodes. That should always be the exception. It should only be where people are really mobilised, not because there isn't an alternative. It's very hard, for example, to you know, respect people's confidentiality when you're discussing sensitive matters, for example, such as continence, such as pain, such as feeling low and depressed, such as breaking bad news. In wards which are, you know, essentially too high density, where there isn't a room to bring a patient to have a private discussion, which is a fact in many of our hospitals, and I've visited many of our hospitals across the country with another hat on, and I just think that unless we have some discussion, it's all right for me to say it, but I'm not going to change anything, because I suppose I work in the system and I'm a function of the system. Unless the public really get a grip on this and say to your local representatives, listen, we want some minimum standards of accommodation and care in our hospital. And what should those minimum standards of care and accommodation be? And as I said, it's not that I'm trying to make, or I'm advocating that we make five-star hotels of our hospitals, but what I'm trying to impress is that the environment is a crucial factor in actually making people feel safe, making them feel secure, making relaxing people, and starting the healing process when people are very medically unwell. And I don't think those environments exist across a lot of our hospitals.
Indeed, I've been very, very struck by your article, by your letter, because I have encountered many of these circumstances in hospitals across my lifetime, and so has anybody listening to the kind of things that you're outlining here. You say, I frequently see the frustration etched on their faces. You're talking about the fact that nurses and healthcare assistants in our hospitals manage to look after patients in such conditions, treading the narrow paths between beds, floor cleaning cones, Zimmer frames, and maneuver drug trolleys, hoists and dinners into position, or attend to people, is a constant source of wonder. Because not alone, of course, is this negative impact on the patients, who are ultimately the most important in the whole process, but of course we have the staff who are struggling in these conditions as well.
It is, and our nursing staff are fantastic, and we're blessed in Ireland to still have a very strong vocational, if you like, bent towards working in medicine, nursing, and into health and social care professionals. And I think the public will have seen that vocationalism during the pandemic. And what I mean by that is that people don't go into healthcare in Ireland necessarily for esteem, are certainly not for money in many cases. They go in for it because there's a genuine vocation and a kindness towards their fellow human being, and I mean that in a very genuine sense, and a desire to do something worthwhile that benefits others. And that's a very strong vocation that still exists in the Irish system, and it's something that can be a tremendous asset. But we have a problem in our health service with retaining staff, and an important function of that is the environment. I mean, if you take some of our graduate nurses coming out now, it's very hard to expose them to some of the environments in our hospital and say this is going to be your working future, when they know they can go to much better designed environments in the private sector, in Australia, or even into community jobs. And people are fleeing the hospital sector. And we have a constant recruitment problem now. We have over 700 consultant vacancies in the hospital sector. You will have seen on the news last night with the protests outside Connolly Hospital, the constant challenge it is to try and recruit nurses. And that protest outside Connolly Hospital, I can tell you, is just an example of what's going on right across our hospital system. And the reality of it is that an environment, the working environment, is a very important consideration when people choose where they're going to work. And it's very hard to ask people to work in very, very difficult conditions in what is already a tough job. No one denies that healthcare.
And I spoke with a family member over the weekend who told me that they were in hospital for a day and that they could not believe how overwhelmed the nursing staff were. And in fact, some of the nurses making the point, look, we've so much paperwork to do now, we can't find the time to do what we're supposed to be doing, taking care of patients. And you pointed out in your article, in your letter, from a staff hygiene point of view, many of our hospitals still have no showering or changing facilities for staff. It's still, after all these years, somewhat bizarre to me, having worked in a pharmaceutical plant environment with dangerous substances where you showered and changed in and showered and changed out, that this basic principle is not mandated and resourced across our hospital system. You also make a point, Professor Collins, regarding there is rarely space for patients just to be able to cry or to express emotion for themselves or others in a secure private environment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people in hospital, obviously, by virtue of the fact that they're in hospital, are very ill, and many will have complex problems. And, you know, that's emotionally stressful for most people. But, you know, it's very hard for people to express that. You know, when you're on a ward, you know, with maybe close contact with 7 or 8 people, and, you know, where is the room to express that in a kind of a private way? You know, and it's not just that, it's just, you know, the feeling that people should be able to allow vomit when they're very ill in private and not feel embarrassed about it on an open ward. And then there's the infection control issues. And also, of course, as I said, going back to the staff who are looking after patients, trying to protect patients' privacy and dignity in those type of settings can be very difficult.
And at the most important time of all, when a person is at the end of life.
Absolutely.
I recall a time when I was in a public ward when a friend was drawing their last breaths, and how distressing that was for the family, number one. But to me, even more distressing, and it wasn't a family member, it was a friend, was the fact that there were patients in other beds who were listening to what was happening, and only that curtain, that plastic curtain that you referred to, the only thing between them and the impending death of this individual.
Yeah, and you know, those experiences can be very difficult for people to witness and for the family of someone who's dying. Now, to be fair, almost all hospital staff will endeavour to try and get someone who's dying into a single room so they can be with their family. Mm. But you're right, at times we don't have enough. And as I said, sometimes, to give you the other side of the coin, sometimes, you know, a properly designed open ward can be a source of comfort to people as well, to feel that there's someone in this with them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'm asking for a proper design, though. We do need far more single rooms, and we do need to be giving people options because, as I said, the environment is a very, very important point of people healing and getting better. And as you mentioned about palliative care and dying, I always stress upon my junior doctors as well, you know, one of the most important things is to actually ensure that a person dies well, because it leaves a lasting impression on the family and also a reflection on ourselves about how that person's life was valued and respected by our health service. And it is a fundamentally important thing to have right, that people feel that their loved one is pain-free, that they're with them. And you know, we will have seen, you will have heard and seen the effects of what it was like during the pandemic for people not to be, have been with their relatives when they were dying, which is something that we went to great lengths here personally to try and avoid, to make sure that people were with their relatives at all times.
And that's been so important over the last
Absolutely.
Year and a half with the pandemic and people passing with often without the presence of their families and so on. So you finish up by saying, why do we tolerate this? I have witnessed these awful environments across countless of our hospitals over many years, and change is urgently needed. You reference Sláinte Care, which you say is correct and ambitious in its aim to provide more care in the community, but that won't solve our hospital problem. Then I wonder, Professor Collins, what will? Because we bucket millions and millions of euro every year into the health sector. It's never enough. We're always in crisis. All of the things that you've pointed out, people, that will resonate with our listeners. And we hear the Minister for Health this morning on our news bulletins, you know, he's getting an extra 400 or 500 million a year, and it will do this, it will do that, it will do the other. Why is this happening then still? Where is all this money going?
Well, healthcare, first of all, is expensive. And as technology advances, we can do more and more. And that means that, I suppose, inflation in healthcare can be astronomical. And for a small country like us, I actually think we do very well in terms of our outcomes and in providing high-tech care, given that we're not the richest country in the world. For example, in my own field of medicine, just to put some balance in the argument, in my own field of medicine, last year we provided a very modern treatment for stroke, which is retrieval of a clot in a blocked vessel in the brain. It's a very new treatment, a very specialised treatment, and we provided that to over 9% of our stroke population, whereas the UK managed less than 2%. So that's some balance in it. So we are achieving, and our stroke outcomes in that regard are good. And similarly, if you look at the league tables for outcomes in cancer and outcomes in cardiovascular disease as well, we're actually probably mid-table in Europe in most of those things. So for a small country, we're not doing too badly. So a lot of money has gone into that. But in general terms, I suppose, when it comes to my comments about slowing to care, what I'm worried about is that while the emphasis on the community is very important, because you want to prevent people from having to go to hospital, and preventative medicine and primary care is very important, and also you want people to get home and rehabilitating at home, because that's much better for them psychologically. But this has to be balanced. You can't treat an acute stroke or an acute heart attack or do cancer surgery in the community. So you can't just ignore the hospital investment. And we need a planned, rolling, continuous investment for upgrading and refitting our hospitals. It's a continuous thing. You can't just build a hospital and walk away. In many countries, for example, they build a hospital and they're already planning in 20, 25 years' time how they're going to decommission that hospital and build another one, because the community that it serves will have changed and moved on, etc., etc. And we don't have that kind of strategic rolling planning going on in Ireland. So that's one aspect of it, I think, that does need to be addressed. And I suppose I think the public need to get more informed, involved in the debate, because, as I said, my voice will be seen as a medical voice, or I'll be accused of being a self-interested voice, or I'll be accused of, you know, being disloyal to the HSE or whatever. And none of those things. We're all in this together in a real sense. It's our health service, and we have to put a framework on it, and that involves the public getting involved in the debate as well.
And yet, Professor Collins, all shrug our shoulders as we wait in A&E, as we join those queues to get appointments and everything else. And we tend to shrug our shoulders, we give out about it and everything else, and we say, sure, look, that's the way it is, what can you do?
Well, you see, there needs to be a root branch analysis, and one of the things you don't see, when you see arguments about, for example, the AD is overcrowded, what you don't see then is that, why is it overcrowded? And, you know, there needs to be a proper analysis of it's overcrowded. So on any given day that you have an emergency department overcrowded, I'd be looking at, number one, all the referrals. Why are all these referrals coming in, right? So where are they coming from? Are they all accidents or unexpected events? Are they all planned events? Are they all referred people who had been waiting for example, diagnostics? And the GPs referred them into the emergency department because the person has been waiting for an ultrasound for 2 months and the GP is worried and therefore he's no other option. So the first thing is to understand why all the people are being referred to the emergency department and what can be done about that. The second thing then is that once people are in the emergency department, an analysis of what is going on there. What is actually causing the waiting list? And then with regard to decisions about admissions, there needs to be some analysis as well, and who makes those decisions. Because the decision to admit someone to a hospital is a very serious decision. It's serious for the patient, it's serious for the hospital, because it's an expensive resource. I mean, a hospital is the most expensive hotel in the country. It costs over £1,000 to spend the night in a hospital. That's the real cost of it.
And so
there needs to be a root analysis of all that as well, so to try and actually tease out to begin improving the process. You mentioned paperwork, Clem, and I'll come back to paperwork. Our hospitals, to my mind, you're absolutely right, and the nurses themselves would say this, they're swamped with paperwork and they can't look after patients because there's paperwork for this and paperwork for that. Some of the paperwork is important. A lot of the paperwork reflects our societal problem. around, if you don't mind me saying so, about medical negligence and suing the health service. And a lot of the paperwork is geared, unfortunately, towards protecting ourselves against that phenomenon. Now, this is a societal problem. And we do have a societal problem in Ireland in general, I think, with litigation.
You know, Professor Collins, I could talk to you for another hour about this, and indeed, I would look forward to talking to you again.
Well, what I would like to say, Clem, to the listeners in Kildare is that, listen, you know, just have a chat with your representatives, particularly, because I'm not asking just for people who work in the health service. You know, forget the rounds of applause and bank holidays. If you offer the vast majority of people who work in the health service, and I don't want this to be interpreted as, oh, well-paid doctors, as I don't want a bonus, but the majority of people, if you really ask them, they'd probably say, God, if you gave us better ward conditions and stuff like that, we'd prefer that to a bonus. And not only would you be helping us do our job, but you'd be helping your loved ones and you'll be helping yourselves in the future. So please get involved in this debate.
On that very positive note, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and indeed I hope we'll talk again in the future, and I can't even begin to imagine what a busy schedule you have, and you've taken so much time to join us this morning here on Kildare Today. Consultant physician in geriatric and stroke medicine at Talla Hospital, Professor Ronan Collins. Thank you so much, Professor Collins.
You're very welcome. Okay, bye-bye.
And good morning to you. How evocative and indeed how thought-provoking is that particular contribution? We'll leave it to you to just dwell on what he has described. I think it's something every single one of us out there, both from a patient perspective and a healthcare perspective, if you're working in the system, will, everything he has said will resonate with everybody. And isn't that a damning indictment of our health system?
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Right, I think Professor Ronan Collins' contribution are extremely impressive and outlining the conditions in our hospitals. So don't forget, get your messages in 0833 97 97 97. That's for text or WhatsApp, or you can email studio at kfmradio.com, or indeed you can call us on 045 898 999. If what Professor Collins said resonates with you in terms of your experiences in the hospital system. On a more positive note, the HICWES is issued its latest inspections of nursing homes, and it carried out one on Mount Pleasant Lodge Nursing Home on the Clane Road in Kilcock. It was an unannounced inspection on the 12th of July 2021, and I have to say it overall very, very positive. The number of residents on the date of the inspection was 56 in regards to that, and of course they go in, they speak with patients, they speak with management, and they speak with staff as well, and they open the report by saying, from what residents told inspectors and from what was observed, it was evident that residents were happy living in Mount Pleasant Lodge, and their rights were respected in how they spent their days. The home as a whole had a calm and tranquil atmosphere. Residents who spoke with inspectors expressed great satisfaction with the staff and the service provided to them. Those residents who could not articulate for themselves appeared very relaxed. It was clear that staff took good care in dressing and attending to the personal care of residents who could not perform such activities unassisted. Now, they had a short opening meeting. They found that residence accommodation and living space was laid out over two floors, which were served by a lift and so on. The inspectors spoke directly with individual residents who said they were very, very happy with the care that they were receiving and with the way the staff were investigating or interacting with them as well. On the day of the inspection, there were 56 residents living in Mount Pleasant Lodge. The profile of the management team is also profiled. And it also says on page 8 of the report, staff had access to an extensive list of mandatory and supplementary training, which included infection control, safeguarding vulnerable adults, manual handling, fire training, medication management, dementia care and wound care. And a sample of the residents' contracts were reviewed. Residents and family members spoken with told inspectors they would know how to make a complaint. In terms of staffing, Owen, Regulation 15, what did it say?
Yeah, on the day of the inspection, there was a sufficient number of staff available with the appropriate skills to meet the assessed individual needs of residents, given the size of the layout of the centre. Planned and actual staff rotas were available and reviewed, and the judgment there was that they were compliant. In terms of training and staff development, records were reviewed showed that mandatory training was up to date for all staff working in the centre. Again, they were compliant there, while in insurance there was a valid contract of insurance against injury to residents and to protect their property, again compliant.
And it was also in governance and management. It says it was this was a well-governed centre with good leadership, governance and management arrangements in place. Management were known to staff and residents, compliant. In terms of the contract for provision of services, they were compliant. In regards a complaint procedure, regulation 34.
Yeah, there was an effective complaints procedure in the centre. This was displayed throughout the centre. There was a nominated person who dealt with complaints and a nominated person to oversee the management of said complaints. Again, they were compliant. Written policies and procedures. Policies and procedures as set out in the schedule were in place and available to all staff in the centre. Again, compliant.
And in quality and safety, inspectors found that residents received a safe service which enhanced their quality of life. Staff supported residents to access health services and to make choices about their daily living routines and activities. Residents' welfare was maintained by good quality evidence-based care. The centre was clean and furnished in a homely manner to meet the needs of residents, and there was just a few decor improvements needed here and there. Now moving on then down the line on to pages that deal with other issues of compliance, and we're moving through page 14 and regulation 11 in terms of visits.
A comprehensive system was in place in line with HPSC guidance to ensure resident safety while being able to welcome visitors to the designated centre, compliant. Personal possessions, the registered provider had a policy in place to guide staff on the management of residents' personal possessions. Residents had a chest of drawers and a wardrobe for storage in their rooms. They were compliant there. And in terms of premises,